You know, the last verse of the hymn that we sang, Blessed Bible, search we may for many years, still some new rich gem appears. And isn't that the way the Bible is and our Bible study goes? You might look at a particular topic one day or one year, and you come back to it again, and you see a new lesson, a fresh lesson, a different lesson. It doesn't mean that lesson that you saw the year before is any less precious to you, but you do find new things. Yesterday we had a couple of discourses by the Kramer brothers. They both touched upon the yoke, and they both gave some different thoughts and some different lessons on the yoke. Brother Dan touched upon keeping the ordinance forever. He talked about the Passover throughout the years in the nation of Israel, and each new Passover taught a different lesson. And Brother John Baker opened yesterday with the zeal for thine house hath consumed me, talking about Jesus' actions in the temple with the turning over the tables of the money changers, the casting out of those who were selling the sacrificial animals, and he brought out many precious lessons in that discourse. And so we're going to look at that same lesson a little bit today as well, like one of those gems from the Bible, and we're going to look at it, and we'll see a different facet. And I think we can all appreciate how the Lord can direct us in our studies to see all these beautiful gems that he's laid for us in his scriptures. And so we'll begin our lesson entitled The Fig Tree and the Temple. When we think of what the fig tree represents in the scriptures, what immediately comes to our minds? We think of the nation of Israel. And when Jesus comes looking for ripe figs on a fig tree and he finds none, what does he do? He curses the fig tree, and the fig tree is destroyed. And we believe this symbolically represents the destruction of the nation of Israel for their failure to bear fruit during the time of the Jewish age harvest. And when we think of the temple in Jerusalem, what comes to mind? Probably many images, but one of them would be the place where God is represented to dwell in the Holy of Holies, the place where sacrifice is acceptable, the place where the covenant is ratified year by year. It is the holiest and the most sanctified place in Israel. When Jesus went into the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the dove sellers, what's the first thing that comes to your mind as to why Jesus did this and what it represented? It's probably that these activities were degrading the holiness of God's house, and Jesus was demonstrating that the temple needed to be cleansed from those activities. Now, where in the Gospels do we find Jesus cursing the fig tree and cleansing the temple? In Matthew 21, verses 12 to 18, Jesus cleansed the temple, and then on the next day, he cursed the fig tree, and it withers away. In Mark 11, 13 and 14, Jesus curses the fig tree. Later in the same day, he cleanses the temple. And then, on the morning of the next day, Jesus and the 12 passed by the fig tree, and Peter points out that it had dried up by its roots. In Luke 13, verses 6 to 9, Jesus doesn't actually curse a fig tree. Instead, he tells a parable of a fig tree being cursed for not bearing fruit. And then six chapters later, in Luke 19, verses 45 and 46, Jesus cleanses the temple. In John, there is no cursing of the fig tree at all. Then in John 2, verses 13 to 16, and seemingly not long after Jesus' first miracle of turning water into wine at the wedding of Cana, Jesus cleanses the temple. Now, what is the point of going through all this. It's really just to demonstrate that the different gospel writers present the cursing of the fig tree and the cleansing of the temple in totally different ways. And of all the gospel accounts, I'm going to use Mark's for our lesson today, because he alone intentionally ties the cursing of the fig tree and the cleansing of the temple together to form a single lesson. Well, how, you might ask, does Mark do this? Well, that will be the focus of our discourse. Today, we'll be looking at the cursing of the fig tree and the cleansing of the temple in order to demonstrate how they are related in Mark's gospel. Now, these events are found in Mark, verses 11, 12 to 23, and I'm going to be reading from the Revised Standard Version. Mark 11, 12 to 23. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, he was hungry, and seeing in the distance a fig tree and leaf, he went to see if he could find anything on it. But when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard it. And they came to Jerusalem and entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he taught and said to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations'? But you have made it a den of robbers." And the chief priests and the scribes heard it and sought a way to destroy him, for they feared him, because all the multitude was astonished at his teaching. And when evening came, they went out to the city. As they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. And Peter remembered and said to him, "Master, look, the fig tree which you cursed has withered." And Jesus answered them, "Have faith in God. Truly, I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, 'Be taken up and cast into the sea,' and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will come to pass, it will be done for him." Mark begins the Monday morning of Jesus' last week with the cursing of the fig tree. On the same day, Jesus does what is usually referred to as the cleansing of the temple. And then on the next day, Tuesday morning, Mark concludes the lesson of the fig tree with the apostles seeing the fig tree Jesus had cursed the day before, now withered away to its roots. Picture these two lessons of the fig tree and the temple to be a sandwich, which has two pieces of bread on the outside and some meat in between. The fig tree lesson is the two pieces of bread, and the temple incident is the meat in between. They can be taken separately, like they are in Matthew. But when you put them together, as Mark did, they make a single meal, and they teach a single lesson. By making the fig tree lesson in two parts, the two pieces of bread, and placing the temple incident, the meat, in between that two-part lesson, it seems that Mark intends for us to look at these two incidents together. And by combining the two lessons to make a single lesson, what is it that Mark wants us to see? I think it's that the fig tree and the temple are tied together. And what happens to the one will happen to the other. And that what happened to the one will help to interpret what happened to the other. The fig tree, as we know, represents Israel and its being destroyed for its failure to produce the fruit of faithfulness as a nation during the time of the Jewish age harvest prepares us for the following and connected lesson of what is commonly called the cleansing of the temple. But I'm going to suggest that it could also be looked at as a symbolic destruction of the temple for its failure to produce the fruit of keeping the law covenant, summed up by Jesus as loving God supremely and your neighbor as yourself. By Mark deliberately making the fig tree a two-part lesson and placing the temple lesson in between those two parts, it suggests that Mark wants us to understand that Jesus' actions in the temple and his actions with the fig tree are not to be looked at as separate lessons, one being destruction of the nation and the other greedy merchants taking advantage of the people visiting the temple. Instead, Mark wants us to see only one lesson, and it is that both the fig tree and the temple are to be destroyed because the people of Israel failed to keep their covenant. There is still another similarity between the fig tree and the temple incident that links them together. Now, it may not be easily seen at first, but once you see it, you will recognize it. The similarity I'm referring to is that both involve a prophetic action by Jesus and then a teaching that explained and interpreted that prophetic action. This combination of action followed by teaching is often used for prophetic symbols, and you can probably think of quite a few from the Old Testament prophets. Let us turn now to the temple incident and see if there is any direct scriptural evidence to back up this idea that Jesus' actions in the temple symbolically represent destruction. In the case of the temple incident, the prophetic action is in verse 15 and 16. First, Jesus began to drive out the buyers and sellers. Then he overturned the tables of the money changers and the tables of the dove sellers. And finally, he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. So for a short period of time, Jesus shut down the temple, or at least part of the temple, as everything in Jesus' immediate vicinity came to an abrupt halt. These actions, which don't tell us why Jesus did them, were followed by the teaching in verse 17, which states, "And he taught, saying unto them, Is it not written, My house shall be called of all nations a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves?" Again, we have to ask ourselves, if our premise is true, how does this teaching explain Jesus' actions of why he symbolically destroyed the temple? How specifically does this teaching interpret or explain the prophetic action? What are our options? The most common interpretation is that Jesus was teaching that the temple had become defiled and he wanted to purify it. This interpretation is sometimes sees the issue is that it was wrong for any commercial activity to take place in the temple courts. And sometimes it is seen more specifically as greedy merchants robbing the people by charging way too much for sacrificial animals and for unfair rates of exchange for the purchase of the coins for the temple tax. But is this the only possible interpretation? And are these the only possible reasons that we can think of for why Jesus overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those selling sacrificial doves? Now we want to try to see if the scriptures can support our premise that what Jesus was teaching in that act was the same thing he taught, us as what the meaning of his prophetic act in the temple. Now we want to try to see if the scriptures can support our premise that what Jesus was teaching in that act was the same thing he taught by cursing the fig tree to destruction. According to Mark in verse 17, Jesus interpreted and taught us what the meaning of his prophetic act in the temple was by combining lines from two Old Testament scriptures. From Isaiah 56:7, Jesus says, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations." And from Jeremiah 7:11, "But you have made it a den of robbers." By combining these two scriptures, Jesus points out the reason the temple was to be destroyed. It was because the temple was meant to be an all-inclusive house of prayer, but it had become a den of robbers. But how can we be sure we know what this actually means? We have to go back to the source of these two scriptures and read them in context to know what Jesus was trying to teach us in connection to his demonstration in the temple. Let's look at Isaiah 56 in verses 1 through 7. I'll be reading from the Jewish Publication Society, which contains the first part of Jesus' teaching about the temple being a house of prayer for all peoples. Isaiah 56, 1 to 7. "Thus saith the Lord, keep ye justice and do righteousness, for my salvation is near to come, and my favored to be revealed. Happy is the man that doeth this, and the son of man that holdeth fast by it, that keepeth the Sabbath from profaning it, and keepeth his hand from doing any evil. Neither let the alien that hath joined himself to the Lord speak, saying, the Lord will surely separate me from his people. Neither let the eunuch say, behold, I am a dry tree. For thus saith the Lord concerning the eunuchs that keep my Sabbaths, and choose the things that please me, and hold fast by my covenant. Even unto them will I give in my house and within my walls a monument and a memorial better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting memorial that shall not be cut off. Also the aliens that join themselves to the Lord to minister unto him and to love the name of the Lord, to be his servants, every one that keepeth the Sabbath from profaning it and holdeth fast by my covenant, even them will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be acceptable upon mine altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. What do we understand the portion of these scriptures quoted by Jesus, specifically verse 7, to mean? What is the point? And what can it teach us concerning the destruction of the temple? The point of these verses seems to be that God's temple was meant to include everyone with a heart to do God's will and follow God's law. No one in the right heart condition was to be excluded or denied the opportunity of entering into that covenant relationship. These included the entire nation of Israel, but especially singled out are the downcast groups of people within Israel's society, as well as all the outsiders who wanted to become proselytes. All of these left out groups of people are represented by Isaiah as eunuchs and aliens. The temple was to be called, of all people, a house of prayer. And you had better include these disadvantaged groups of people who your leaders so often tend to forget. But instead of including and defending the God-given privileges and rights of such groups, who were the least able to defend themselves, they had been excluded from the temple and the relationship with God that the temple represented. The temple, according to Isaiah, was not a house of prayer for all people, because some who wanted to be a part of it were being intentionally left out. It seems that the rulers of the temple in Isaiah's day were just like those in Jesus' day. They were treating the temple like their own private club, and they were denying membership to those that they deemed to be unworthy. In Isaiah's day, they were the eunuchs and the aliens. In Jesus' day, they were the sinners, the tax collectors, and the harlots. And on top of this, the temple in Isaiah's day and in Jesus' day had become a den of robbers. This phrase conjures up a peculiar image of a bunch of desperados hiding out in the caves of the Badlands after robbing the stagecoach. But is this a correct image, or should we look for something else? And this leads to our second scripture that Jesus quoted as part of his teaching concerning his actions in the temple. We go now to Jeremiah 7, and we'll look at the context surrounding the den of robbers. Jeremiah 7, verses 1 through 4. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, "Stand in the gate of the Lord's house, and proclaim there this word, and say, Hear the word of the Lord, all ye of Judah, that enter in at these gates to worship the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. Trust not in lying words, saying, The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these. Just how are the words, the temple of the Lord, lying words? If the buildings they were pointing to really were the temple, then what were the people lying about? They were lying to themselves that going to the temple and following all its rules and making the appropriate sacrifices at the right times was all it took to be acceptable to God. They thought if they did that inside the temple, God wouldn't care that they didn't love their neighbor or treat them respectfully or justly outside of the temple. They lied to themselves, and they thought that following the letter of the law towards God in the temple would guarantee their protection and prosperity promised under the law covenant, and that God would never take away their nation and especially their temple. But God says to them, they have to keep the covenant by truly loving God and their fellow man when that they are outside of the temple, or God will utterly reject their hypocritical worship when they are inside of the temple. Jeremiah 7, verses 5 through 11. Nay, but if you thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if you thoroughly execute justice between a man and his neighbor, if you oppress not the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, and shed not innocent blood in this place, neither walk after other gods to your hurt, then will I cause you to dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever. Behold, you trust in lying words that cannot profit. Will you steal, murder, and commit adultery, and swear falsely, and offer unto Baal, and walk after other gods whom you have not known, and come and stand before me in this house, whereupon my name is called, and say, we are delivered, that you may do all these abominations? Is this house, whereupon my name is called, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, I, even I, have seen it, saith the Lord. In this context, the meaning of the phrase den of robbers becomes much clearer. It was the people's everyday unloving and unjust treatment of their neighbors, but especially their taking unfair advantage of the weakest ones, the ones who couldn't defend themselves, the strangers, the fatherless, and the widows, that makes them robbers, robbing their neighbors of the treatment they deserve under the law covenant. And they think the temple is their safe house, their den, their hideaway, their place of security, where they can go for protection from God after they have acted unjustly and done their thievery in their everyday dealings with their neighbors. The temple, the place of worship, is clearly not the place where the robbery, the stealing, murder, adultery, false witnessing, and idolatry takes place. But it is the place where those who do those things go for refuge. It is their den. But God is saying through Jeremiah that he rejects their worship inside the temple because of their lack of doing God's will of loving their neighbor outside of the temple. God is saying that worship cannot be substituted for loving your brother and your neighbor and treating them justly. What comes next is a terrible threat of what will happen if worship in the house of God continues as a substitute for doing God's will in the land of God. This is what will happen. Jeremiah 7, verses 12 to 14. For go ye now unto my place which is in Shiloh, where I caused my name to dwell at the first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel. And now, because you have done these works, saith the Lord, and I spoke to you, speaking betimes and often, but you heard not. And I called you, but you answered not. Therefore will I do unto the house whereupon my name is called, whereupon you trust, and unto the place which I gave to you and to your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh. Shiloh, which was destroyed by the Philistines in 1 Samuel 4, was the place where the Ark of the Covenant originally dwelt in the tabernacle of God before it was removed and eventually placed in the temple built by Solomon on Mount Moriah. The threat is very clear. If God's temple is used as a place where worship is substituted for doing God's will in the land of God, then God will destroy the temple. Since it has become a haven for religious hypocrites who treat their fellow men unjustly, and a den where those robbers seek safety and security. The people had lied to themselves to the point they were convinced that if they continued their outward show of proper temple worship, that God would protect his temple from ever coming to any harm, and especially from foreign invasion. But God says through Jeremiah that he himself will destroy his temple if the people of the nation refuse to live up to the spirit of the law. And the fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy resulted in the Babylonian captivity and the destruction of Solomon's temple. And this brings us back to our original premise from Mark 11, that Jesus' actions and teaching in the temple symbolically represent the destruction of the temple, and for the same reasons Jeremiah gave for the destruction of the first temple. Worship in the temple had become a substitute for doing God's will in the land of God. Jesus' acts of totally disrupting and for a short time shutting down the temple's sacrificial and economic activities are best understood, I believe, by his teaching that followed, and in the context from which Jesus quoted Isaiah and Jeremiah. And that teaching, according to the context we've just looked at, had nothing to say along the lines that the money changers or the animal sellers were the robbers. Even if, and they probably were, even if some of them may not have been perfectly just in their dealings, they were still performing a legitimate function. The money changers in the court of the Gentiles were needed so that the Jewish pilgrims could pay the temple tax in the only approved coinage. And the buying and selling of animals on site was a good way that traveling pilgrims could be sure that those animals were ritually clean and acceptable for sacrifice. The sellers of doves were providing a service to the poor people, who were allowed to sacrifice birds rather than the larger and more expensive animals. When Jesus quoted a part of Jeremiah's prophecy concerning the den of thieves and God's threat to destroy Solomon's temple, like he destroyed Shiloh, it was not to point out or to suggest that the temple in Jesus' day needed to be cleansed from the greedy profiteering of merchants, or that it was somehow not proper that they were even in the temple courts, as if everything would have been all right if they had just charged a little less, or if they moved their business to an off-site location. That is one lesson, surely, but it's not the only lesson. And if the context of Jeremiah has any bearing at all on Jesus' words, then that's not what Jesus primarily meant when he said, "You have made the temple a den of robbers." Jesus was accusing the entire Jewish nation of wrongdoing. They had not developed the fruit he desired and expected to find during the time of the Jewish age harvest. But he was especially indicting the hypocritical religious leaders who sat in Moses' seat and were the most powerful, influential, and therefore the most responsible members of the nation. The "you" in Mark 11:17, when Jesus said, "You have made it a den of robbers," isn't primarily referring to the money changers or the dove sellers, but to the people's everyday injustice and lack of brotherly love in dealing with each other, but especially to the temple establishment and their teachings and activities, which represented the entire Jewish nation. The law was to be a schoolmaster that led the nation to Christ. It had been used instead to teach as God's law the precepts of their learned men and to ensure the privileged place of the temple authority as the leaders of the nation and the teachers of the law. Let's look now at the destruction of the fig tree and see how Mark tied it to the temple incident. In the case of the fig tree, the prophetic action is in verse 14 of Mark 11, where Jesus said to the fig tree, "Let no man eat fruit of thee hereafter forever." Even though this seems like a teaching because Jesus spoke it, this is only an action, not a teaching, because there is no indication as to what Jesus' words might be referring to. It gives us no indication or teaching as to why no fruit would ever be eaten from the fig tree again. For the teaching of what this prophetic action means, we have to go to verse 23, where we find Jesus and his disciples all standing by the withered fig tree. When Peter pointed out to Jesus that the fig tree he had cursed yesterday is now withered away, it is then Jesus teaches the lesson that interpreted the action when he said, "Truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, 'Be taken up and cast into the sea,' and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will come to pass, it will be done for him." At first glance, the mountain being cast into the sea doesn't seem to teach anything about the fig tree. But when we remember that we have to include the temple incident in the lesson, it starts to be more clear, because the temple incident is going to help interpret or teach us about the fig tree, just as the destruction of the fig tree helps us interpret the lesson of the temple incident. So we must ask ourselves, how specifically does this teaching of the mountain being cast into the sea explain Jesus' action in cursing to destruction the fig tree? And how is the mountain being cast into the sea also related to the temple incident? What mountain is this? It is Mount Moriah. And what does Mount Moriah have to do with this fig tree? And what does Mount Moriah have to do with the temple? Where is the similarity? And where is the connection? It can only be that the fig tree and the temple were both on Mount Moriah. This seemingly out-of-place reference to the mountain after the destruction of the fig tree is the key to understanding Jesus' symbolic action in the temple. When Mount Moriah is thrown into the sea, what will become of the temple? because the temple sits on Mount Moriah, it too will be thrown into the sea and destroyed. So we see the connected lesson Mark is teaching us. Jesus cursed the fig tree to destruction and followed it with a teaching about the mountain being cast into the sea. The mountain cast into the sea represents the destruction of the fig tree and the destruction of the temple. Jesus' actions in the temple teach the same lesson as the fig tree. The fig tree was literally destroyed, and Jesus was symbolically destroying the temple by temporarily shutting it down. The temple is the most visual representation of the covenant between God and the nation of Israel. And when Israel had been judged as failing to keep the covenant, the temple, like the fig tree, had to be destroyed. Well, the question that we want to address now is not so much prophetic, but practical, and one that we don't give much thought to. And the question is this. In Jesus' day, and in the time of Roman dominion over Israel, besides its role in denying access to the sinners, who the scribes and Pharisees had determined were not worthy of God's favor, what was it about the temple in Jerusalem and what it represented that it had become a den of robbers and had to be destroyed? I believe, and this is more personal opinion than scriptural, I believe it is in large part the role the temple played in not upholding the Abrahamic and the law covenant that guaranteed the land to the families of Israel. As we read in Numbers 33:54 concerning the land, "And ye shall divide the land for lot for an inheritance among your families, and to the more you shall give the more inheritance, and to the fewer you shall give the less inheritance. Every man's inheritance shall be in the place where his lot falleth, according to the tribes of your fathers, ye shall inherit." God had promised the people an inheritance in the land. And Rome, with the cooperation of the temple authorities, had taken the land away from the people. When it comes to the land of Israel, it is a historical fact that when Rome took over Israel, they changed how things were done, and especially how the land was used. In a non-industrial society, like Israel was in Jesus' day, where most of the economy depends on how you use the land, a bunch of small family farms, where the families eat most of the produce, didn't have any economic benefit for Rome. So they took the old system of independent family farmers growing what they need to live, and they changed it into a system of large estates which had large tracts of land producing things that could be sold and exported, with the majority of the profits going to Rome, sort of like how factory farming in our day has replaced the family farmer. This new Roman system, by its very nature, forced peasants off their land where for centuries they had produced what they needed for their families. Over a period of several decades of Roman rule, and due to this new economic system of land usage, peasant families, who no longer had ownership of any land of their own, were forced to become tenant farmers, sharecroppers, day laborers, or beggars on the street corners. Now, someone local had to own and run these large farms and orchards and vineyards at a good profit for themselves and at a great profit for Rome. Who among Jewish society were wealthy and educated enough to do this? Is it any surprise that the owners of many of these large estates were among the temple authority? And this situation, where the wealthy few owned the majority of the land, seems to be a fulfillment of Isaiah 5:8, when Isaiah said, "Woe unto them that join house to house, that lay field to field, till there be no place, that they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth." But we ask ourselves, who is to blame for this system of enriching one class of people at the expense of another class of people? It's easy just to blame the rich. But in this case, just because these individuals among the temple authority had become wealthy and powerful, as the peasants suffered serious decline, does not mean that they were necessarily corrupt. They may well have been honest, good-hearted people. The issue is not their individual virtue or wickedness. The issue is the role they played in the system of government that Jesus condemned as unjust. The temple had become a den of robbers. It had become a part of a system that by not defending and upholding the land provisions of the law covenant had robbed its fellow men of their God-given inheritance. God had given the land to the families of Israel, and it was taken away by Rome with the help of and to the benefit of those in the temple authority. The law covenant guaranteed possession of the land. The covenant had not been kept, and the land had been lost. And the temple had played a part in this. Jesus was not only standing against that particular system and the role the temple played in it, he was also standing against all forms of future religion that would be used throughout the centuries, that would grow rich by cooperating with state-sponsored systems of violence and economic injustice against the people. The fig tree was destroyed for the lack of fruit expected in the Jewish age harvest that God demanded. The temple was shut down for its failure to uphold its responsibility to teach God's will and God's ways concerning the land of Israel, and for the lack of love and justice for the people that God demanded. Our God is a God of justice and righteousness, and that is what he requires in those who would worship him and make a covenant with him, and especially of those who claim to be the teachers and the leaders. All who claim a covenant relationship with God are called to worship in spirit and in truth. But when worship is substituted for acting justly, for loving God above all, and your neighbors as yourselves, then God rejected Solomon's temple in Jeremiah's day. He rejected Herod's temple in Jesus' day. And God, in 1878, began to separate the wheat from the tares as he rejected the false members of the true temple in our day. The destruction of the fig tree, the nation of Israel, and the destruction of the temple are tied together in doctrine and in historical fact. Jesus said in 33 AD, "Your house is left unto you desolate. In 70 AD, both their national house and their house of worship, their temple, were destroyed by Rome. Now, what in practical terms can we learn from Israel's experiences along this line? The lesson for us today, and it's only one small, simple lesson. The lesson for us today is that it is only by just and loving behavior towards our brethren and our neighbors, combined with proper religious observation, that we, the people of God, the living stones of God's temple, can have and maintain a right standing before Him. If that means that we have to sometimes stand against the systems of this world, and by so doing, we don't profit by them, then we can count that as part of our sacrifice. May God help us to understand love, to understand righteousness, so that we might act justly and compassionately with each other and with our neighbors, so that we are never guilty of substituting worship for acting justly and lovingly, so that it never, ever can be said of us. It can never be said of us, as it was said to the fleshly house of Israel, that we have made our temples, our places of worship, a den of thieves. May the Lord add His blessing. Mm-hmm.